on Race and Ethnic Disparities report on race said there was no evidence to suggest that Britain was an institutionally racist place. Recently, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, told Parliament, "For centuries, our United Kingdom has had a proud history of welcoming people from overseas." Simon Woolley, the former Chief Executive Officer of Operation Black Vote and chair of the No. 10 Race Disparity Unit, July 2020, said the refusal to make the report public was shameful. Simon Woolley said the government is hell-bent in its denial of the systemic nature of racial inequality, and in this climate, historical facts have become uncomfortable truths that need to be hidden. The report also cites a letter from the Prime Minister to the Federation of the West Indies, Sir Grantley Adams, to the Conservative Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. Sir Grantley Adams protested that Britain has begun to take steps which are no different in kind to the basis on which the system of apartheid in South Africa is based, by introducing the 1962 Commonwealth Immigrants Act. Juanita Cox, a research fellow with the Institute of Commonwealth Studies working on a Windrush scandal research project, said if they admitted the Home Office's legislation pre-1981 was institutionally racist, current legislation might also come under scrutiny and be found to be even worse. Britain's immigration system is at complete odds with the proud image it portrays of welcoming immigrants. Immigration barrister Grace Brown, who has acted for a number of Windrush victims, said the fallout from the legislation was still being felt. She said, "There's no justifiable reason why the continuing and long-lasting effect on individuals of historic discriminatory legislation and policy shouldn't be addressed and corrected today." A Home Office spokesperson said the department would not name the historian who wrote the history, claiming that the Home Office was making progress towards becoming a more compassionate and open organisation.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to the latest instalment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm David Miller. This week, we have a special edition of the show, which will examine a British Zionist group which has been harassing and intimidating pro-Palestine activists. Its latest salvo of attacks has been on staff in higher education. We will concentrate today on the case of Shahad Abu Salama, the Palestinian academic suspended and then reinstated at Sheffield Hallam University, whose inspiring fight back against intimidation tactics has shown that Zionists will not always have things their own way. In this special edition of the programme, we'll be joined by Shahad Abu Salama herself to get the inside story of how she won her case. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report on the campaign against anti-Semitism.
This is the story of a secretive organisation which conceals the identity of key figures and seems to use anti-racism as a smokescreen to achieve the foreign policy objectives of the Israeli regime in the UK. The campaign against anti-Semitism was founded in London to divert attention from Israel's massacre of over 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza. The first action was to organise a demonstration against and boycott of the Tricycle Theatre in Kilburn, which wanted to return a small donation from the Israeli embassy for a film festival, the shortfall being made up by the theatre itself. The CAA falsely claimed the theatre had banned the event. The CAA has been funded by Netan, an organisation chaired by Tony Felsen, a strong supporter and donor to the Friends of the Israel Defence Forces. It is also funded by the Jewish National Fund UK, an organisation described by historian Ilan Pape as a colonialist agency of ethnic cleansing which builds settlements in occupied Palestine. Accounts for the JNF UK show that it provides financial backing to recruitment drives for the Israeli Defense Forces and also to Ian Pratt, a group which enlists North Americans into the Army of Occupation. The JNF is currently being investigated by the Charity Commission after its head, Samuel Hayek, made Islamophobic comments using far-right talking points. The JNF UK honorary patrons include the Prime Minister and President of the Israeli regime, as well as Tony Blair and previously former British Prime Minister David Cameron. The chief executive of the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism is Gideon Falter, who simultaneously serves as the vice chair of the JNF UK. CAA also obtained a very unusual dispensation from Companies House and the Charity Commission to keep its directors secret, even after a challenge under Freedom of Information legislation. We can reveal that one of these, listed as unnamed on the CAA website, is actually Daniel Allington, a lecturer for King's College London. Allington's work is funded by the Alfred Landecker Foundation, run by a pro-Israel lobbyist, Andreas Eberhardt. Allington also does work for the CAA as an academic without any public disclosure that he is a director, a clear conflict of interest. The CAA website used to tout its honorary patrons, which included Colonel Richard Kemp, a close friend of Benjamin Netanyahu, who was embedded with the Israeli military in Gaza as it sniped Palestinians on the Great March of Return in 2018. Also, there was Mark Lewis of UK Lawyers for Israel, a lawfare lobby group which works closely with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Despite these honorary patrons proudly associating with CAA, it suddenly made the page on its website unavailable in 2019. Are these individuals no longer patrons? Why the secrecy? The CAA targets pro-Palestine actors with false accusations of anti-Semitism. Before he joined CAA, its director, Gideon Falter, was found to have given a false account of an incident in which a diplomat had denounced Israel. Its reports and research are widely criticized by Jewish groups as flawed and irresponsible. The CAA played a key role in smearing the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn. It submitted a huge dossier to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, including many false and exaggerated accusations of anti-Semitism. The CAA is also pushing the war on academia to silence criticism of Zionism. When racism comes in the guise of anti-racism, the question is, how can we resist?
To discuss the campaign against anti-Semitism and the forces behind it, we're joined today by a special guest, Shahad Abu Salama, who's a Palestinian writer, activist, and artist, who has twice been made a refugee by the Zionist Project. She's an associate lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University, and she's recently completed a PhD on the historical representation of Palestinian refugees in documentary cinema. As Shahad has publicly stated, she was defamed and harassed by Zionist publications and was then suspended from her job. However, after a short but intense campaign, she was reinstated to her position on an enhanced contract. Shahad, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, David, and solidarity with you.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, you must be very relieved at this turn of events. It's been fantastic that you've been reinstated. How do you feel?
Of course, it's a win for Palestine. I see it. And we managed, with the collective action and the people who spoke up in support of me, to turn the tide and expose the malicious accusations that were trying to deflect from Israeli crimes that I witnessed and lived through. So it is a great welcome step from the university. However, the bullying and the trolls and the Zionist media defamation has been nonstop.
Sure. You've brought with you a very interesting book. I think you would like to tell us a bit about how this book relates to some of your back history and how that relates then to the attacks that have been on you.
Yeah, so I'm carrying Felicia Langer's book with my own eyes. Felicia Langer is an Israeli-German lawyer who have defended Palestinian political prisoners since 1967, And she became the lawyer of my father in 1972, when she met him as a 19-year-old, and she recorded his story. My father, this wasn't the first time that he was in prison. He was first in prison when he was 14 or 15 years old. And of course, needless to say that this is a stark violation of international law. Children should be protected, they should be at school, they should be safe in their homes and not subject to such persecution. So the second time that he was arrested, when he was 19 and was defended by Felicia Langer, he pled not guilty. And he didn't do anything except being Palestinian, angry at the realities of the occupation that meant they could have their houses raided in the middle of the night. He speaks here about wait a minute, I want to read this quote as came from my dad. "I saw children getting killed in the streets of the camp," he says. "Shot by the frontier police, they come to the refugee camp with clubs, beat everybody, go into the houses without knocking on the door. There are women inside. They mix flour into the oil during the searches. Yes, maliciously, without a reason." And then he says further about the torture that he received in the investigation that lasted nearly 3 months. And he lost, as a result of that torture, he lost his sense of hearing, 19 years old. And he said that this even included psychological torture. He said, "Then they threatened me, unless I talked, I would be punished to Amman, where I would be killed." And there are a lot more stories here, but this woman has been an example that I grew up with, you know? She is one of the most fearless anti-Zionist voices that spoke and acted on the side of the Palestinians, because she saw the injustice and she renounced her citizenship in 1991, the year I was born, and went to Germany, a luxury that she can do, of course. She left Germany believing that she could not serve justice to the Palestinians under that Israeli apartheid.
And now we come back to today, where organizations like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism have targeted you. Many others have targeted you. You referred to trolls and media. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of effects of that targeting and what kind of groups there are arrayed against you?
So it started actually with Jewish News. I learned from the Zionist press, Jewish News in particular, that my university was investigating me. And that was Christmas Eve. And sadly, the same day, I was mourning the loss of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And I was mourning, and in the same time, I received this disturbing article that says my university is investigating me, and as a staff member and a PhD student at the university, I should be the first to be approached, not the Zionist media. And I wasn't told. I was left in the dark all this time, preparing for my new position as an associate lecturer teaching post-colonial media culture. And I went to the first lecture that was on 17th of January. And I knew that there was, you know, by then there were the Jewish news article and then the campaign against anti-Semitism that skipped over my right to reply completely and just defamed me without paying any consideration to my lived experience or my response to their previous defamations that they raised against me, because this is not the first time that I'm being silenced and demonized. And of course, for the Palestinians, like, we see this as a part of a consistent pattern that predicates on our demonization and the manipulation of our own reality and histories for the justification and the legitimacy of the Israeli state. Yeah.
So we've got another report now, which tells us a little bit more about the background to your case. And we'll come back to talk about more about your experiences after that.
Thank you so much.
A victory for Palestine. Those were the words of Palestinian academic Shahad Abu Salam after news broke that her British university dropped an investigation against her. Shahad Abu Salama, an activist from Gaza, was appointed as an associate lecturer at Sheffield's Hallam University last month, but was suspended from teaching amidst the investigation. She was accused of sharing anti-Semitic views over her past criticism of Israel and the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
The Palestinians have a right to resist their occupier by any means necessary. And this is a right that is entrenched in international law. And no one can take that right from us.
Despite the university's U-turn, an apology remains elusive, despite the immense distress caused.
After a lifelong of struggle, I just want to say that I'm standing here with all of these people. They're all from all sorts of backgrounds, and they're all standing proudly co-resisting Israeli apartheid with me and demanding that freedom, justice, and equality is served to the Palestinians. This is long overdue.
University authorities have not yet specified the group or individuals who filed the complaints which led to the suspension. However, Abu Salama is a high-profile rights campaigner and a vocal critic of the definition of Zionism, leading many to suspect pro-Israel groups are trying to whip up a, quote, witch hunt against her. Abu Salama was supported by her professional body, the Universities and Colleges Union, which passed an emergency motion in her defense. They said her public campaigning against Israel falls entirely within the boundaries of acceptable political commentary. This isn't the first survival battle Abu Salama has faced. She and her family are refugees, ethnically cleansed from their home in what is now Israel by Zionist militias in 1948. Like all other Palestinian refugees, they are barred by Israel from returning to their original homes. Amina Taylor for Palestine Declassified.
Shahad, what did you make of that? Can you bring us up to date with your case?
Thank you for the report. It's a great report and definitely put things in context. At the minute, we're still carrying on, you know, like the anger that the victory has created is still posing pressure on me, but also on my university. My father, who's a freedom fighter, is being accused of being a convicted terrorist, and I'm basically a daughter of a convicted terrorist. And of course, that is an ideological condemnation of a legitimate right to resist. And this is the right that is guaranteed by international law. Like, the right of the occupied people to resist their occupier until liberation. And this is what we're doing. We're trying to reclaim our humanity.
And yet, on campus, there are organizations who are fighting for the rights of the occupier.
Exactly.
The UK Lawyers for Israel, for example, they have people on campus at Sheffield. The Union of Jewish Students there, they have a JSOC on campus there, headed by the daughter of a prominent pro-Israel sociologist. Can you tell us about how that manifests itself, the active involvement, not just of off-campus groups, but on-campus groups?
Yeah. I mean, it is horrendous, really, when I saw the latest report by the Jewish Chronicle that uses Jewish in order to conflate between Zionism and Judaism and quell criticisms of Israel. Yeah. They have made their whole story around me being a terrorist and a daughter of a terrorist, and then how that makes Jews unsafe based on one single statement from the president of JSOC at the University of Sheffield. So imagine the such generic false statement made against a whole university just because they did the right thing. Because they did the right thing.
Yeah.
I was being silenced, and the university knows that they were unfair to me. And what happened in terms of suspension and the university communicating with the Zionist press and feeding into their lies before even approaching me, that was very harmful. That added fuel to fire. And we cannot accept such scaremongering statement that contribute to racial hatred and ethno-religious divisions on campus. We cannot accept that.
So what we find, I think, in your case and in many other cases, in my own case at Bristol, in cases in Warwick and in Glasgow, is the university effectively collaborating with the bullies and the people who are trying to intimidate pro-Palestine activists. Can you say, just in closing, what you think is the way forward for resisting this kind of bullying?
A lot should be done. And I think the production of knowledge in itself is resistance. And this counter-narrative that comes out with programs like this, Palestine Declassified, that that comes with stories such as mine, the Palestinian story that many Palestinians would be able to identify with. We have to resist in whatever we can, with whatever tool we have, because every morning we know Palestinians are waking up to more crimes of ethnic cleansing, of dispossession. The siege is suffocating a whole population in Gaza that is mass incarcerated in the world's largest open-air prison while frequently bombarded. Let's not forget, just last May, 2,070 people were killed. F-16 bombs fell 10 meters away from my house while my family were inside. Can you believe the terror that they lived? And these are serious struggles. These are serious grievances that Israel cannot defend. And that's why they're using the card, abusing the card of anti-Semitism. That is a real issue. And bypassing it and twisting it in order to avoid accountability. And we have to be the pressure that brings Israeli apartheid to justice. We have to be that change. And we are.
But that change also needs to push back against those other forces that are involved, the media you've talked about. Can you tell us about the kind of impact that the media and then the trolls have on ordinary activists on the ground and who are doing work in this area?
I mean, of course, it has a chilling effect. And the IHRA definition has been widely criticized by even the person who drafted it. And he said that it wasn't fit for purpose, and it was only going to feed into racial hatred and division, and probably even anti-Semitism. And this is serious. And there were people who have been saying over and over again that Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, and they are the ones who keep on emphasizing that they are speaking in the name of the world Jewry, when they are far from that. There are more and more Jews around the world that are speaking up against it and saying, no, this is not in my name. No religion would endorse crimes such as this that are being committed in Palestine in daylight, every day. And we are speaking up against it, and we're not going to let their fear-mongering get under our skin. We have a just cause, and we have to resist these forces wherever they are until they are isolated, the same way South African apartheid was isolated, and the people who were part of it were isolated.
So we have to talk about the end of Zionism as an ideology, an ideology which is by its nature racist. And, and one of the first steps surely has to be resisting the IHRA definition, but that's only the first step, surely.
I mean, like the IHRA, before there was the prevent strategy that also affected us seriously, and before that there were lots of unspoken rules that immediately took the side of the oppressor against the oppressed. I mean, like, as a Palestinian, you see that all the time. I've lived through, you know, 22 days of constant bombing against the Gaza Strip, 2008, 2009. I was only 17, attending mid-school exams and studying on candlelight of the scarcity of electricity and in constant fear over my life and my loved ones' lives. And these... And at those times, I've noticed how international media is part of the problem.
Yeah,
we were feeling isolated, being killed in our masses, and displaced over again. My father's school that was turned into a makeshift shelter was bombed with white phosphorus, internationally banned weapons. All these crimes have to be addressed, and they
and
have to be brought...
Yes. Thank you very much. Sorry, that's all we've got time for, Shad. Thank you very much for your inspiring words.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, everyone, and we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. I've been David Miller. Bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Thank you. in the limelight.
Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William I. Robinson, author. This article is published under the heading, Global Capitalism Has Become Dependent on War Making to Sustain Itself. In late March, the Biden administration, citing the Russian military operation, called for a $31 billion increase in the Pentagon budget over the previous year and on top of an emergency appropriation weeks earlier of $14 billion for Ukraine. Prior to the operation in late 2021, the U.S. government approved a nearly $800 billion military budget, even as in the same year it ended the war in Afghanistan. Almost overnight following the Russian operation, the U.S., European Union, and other governments around the world allocated billions of dollars in additional military spending and sent streams of military hardware and private military contractors into Ukraine. Shares of military and security firms surged in the wake of the crisis. 2 weeks into the conflict, shares of Raytheon were up 8%. General Dynamics up 12%, Lockheed Martin up 18%, and Northrop Grumman up 22%, while war stocks in Europe, India, and elsewhere experienced similar surges in expectation of an exponential rise in global military spending. Missing from the larger picture was the centrality of militarized accumulation, of endless low and high-intensity warfare, simmering conflicts, civil strife, and policing to the global political economy. Militarized accumulation refers to a situation in which a global war economy relies on the state to organize war making, social control, and repression to sustain capital accumulation in the face of chronic stagnation and saturation of global markets. These state-organized practices are outsourced to transnational corporate capital, involving the fusion of private accumulation with state militarization in order to sustain the process of capital accumulation. Cycles of destruction and reconstruction provide ongoing outlets for over-accumulated capital. That is, these cycles open up new profit-making opportunities for transnational capitalists seeking ongoing opportunities to profitably reinvest the enormous amounts of cash they have accumulated. There is a convergence in this process of global capitalism's political need for social control and repression in the face of mounting popular discontent worldwide and its economic need to perpetuate accumulation in the face of stagnation. Wars provide critical economic stimulus. They have historically pulled the capitalist system out of accumulation crises while they serve to deflect attention from political tensions and problems of legitimacy. It took the Second World War to finally lift world capitalism out of the Great Depression. The Cold War legitimated a half century of expanding military budgets, and the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, the longest in history, helped keep the economy sputtering along in the face of chronic stagnation in the first two decades of the century. From the anti-communist fervor of the Cold War to the so-called War on Terror, then the so-called New Cold War, and now the Russian operation of Ukraine, and the transnational elite led by Washington have had to conjure up one enemy after another to legitimate militarized accumulation and deflect crises of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony onto external enemies and contrived threats. The events of September 11, 2001 mark the start of an era of a permanent global war in which logistics, warfare, intelligence, repression, surveillance, and even military personnel are more and more the privatized domain of transnational capital. The Pentagon budget increased 91% in real terms between 1998 and 2011, while worldwide total state military budget outlays grew by 50% from 2006 to 2015, from $1.4 trillion to more than $2 trillion. This figure does not take into account the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on intelligence, contingency operations, policing, bogus wars against immigrants, terrorism and drugs, and homeland security. During this time, military-industrial complex profits quadrupled. However, focusing just on state military budgets only gives us a part of the picture of the global war economy. As shown in 2020 book, The Global Police State, the various wars, conflicts, and campaigns of social control and repression around the world involve the fusion of private accumulation with state militarization. In this relationship, the state facilitates the expansion of opportunities for private capital to accumulate through militarization, such as by facilitating global weapon sales by military-industrial security firms, the amounts of which have reached unprecedented levels. Global weapon sales by top 100 weapons manufacturers and military service companies increased by 38% between 2002 and 2016 and can be expected to escalate further in the face of a prolonged crisis in Eastern Europe. By 2018, private for-profit military companies employed some 15 million people around the world, while another 20 million people worked in private security worldwide. The private security policing business is one of the fastest-growing economic sectors in many countries and has come to dwarf public security around the world. The amount spent on private security in 2003, the year of the invasion of Iraq, was 73% higher than that spent in the public sphere. And three times as many persons were employed in private forces as in official law enforcement agencies. In half of the world's countries, private security agents outnumber police officers. These corporate soldiers and police were deployed to guard corporate property, provide personal security for executives and their families, collect data, conduct police, paramilitary, counterinsurgency, and surveillance operations, carry out mass crowd control and repression of protesters, run private detention and interrogation facilities, manage prisons, and participate in outright warfare. Now, these same private military and security firms are pouring into Ukraine, with some mercenary companies offering between $1,000 and $2,000 a day for those with combat experience. The fact that this explosion in spending coincides perfectly with continued worldwide stagnation following the Great Recession suggests that the heightened militarization of the global economy is as much or more a response to this chronic stagnation than to perceived security threats. If bursts of militarized accumulation, such as that unleashed by 9/11, then by the 2008 financial collapse, and now, by the crisis in Eastern Europe, help offset the over-accumulation crisis further into the future, they are also high-risk bets that heighten worldwide tensions and push the world dangerously towards all-out international conflagration. This crisis of global capitalism is economic or structural, one of the chronic stagnation in the global economy, but it is also political, a crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. The system is moving towards a general crisis of capitalist rule as billions of people around the world face uncertain struggles for survival and question a system they no longer see as legitimate. Historically, wars have pulled the capitalist system out of crisis while they serve to deflect attention from political tensions and problems of legitimacy. Economically, global capitalism faces what is known in technical language as overaccumulation, a situation in which the economy has produced or has the capacity to produce great quantities of wealth, but the market cannot absorb this wealth because of escalating inequality. Capitalism, by its very nature, will produce abundant wealth, yet polarize that wealth and generate ever greater levels of social inequality unless offset by redistributive policies. The level of global social polarization and inequality now experienced is without precedent. In 2018, the richest 1% of humanity controlled more than half of the world's wealth, while the bottom 80% had to make do with just 5%. The International Development Agency Oxfam reported in January that during the first 2 years of the coronavirus pandemic, the 10 richest men in the world more than doubled their fortunes from $700 billion to $1.5 trillion, while 99% of humanity saw a fall in their income and 160 million more people fell into poverty. Such inequalities end up undermining the stability of the system as the gap grows between what is or could be produced and what the market can absorb. The extreme concentration of the planet's wealth in the hands of the few and the accelerated impoverishment and dispossession of the majority means that the transnational capitalist class, or TCC, has increasing difficulty in finding productive outlets to upload enormous amounts of surplus it accumulated. In the years leading up to the pandemic, there was a steady rise in the underutilized capacity and slowdown in industrial production around the world. The surplus of accumulated capital with nowhere to go expanded rapidly. Transnational corporations recorded record profits during the 2010s at the same time that corporate investment declined. Along with militarized accumulation, the TCC has turned to unprecedented levels of financial speculation and to debt-driven growth to sustain profit-making in the face of the crisis. If left unchecked, overaccumulation results in crisis, in a stagnation, recessions, depression, social upheavals, and war. Just what people are experiencing right now. But there is a related dynamic at work in the global war economy. The need for dominant groups to suppress mass discontent and deflect the crisis of state legitimacy. International frictions escalate as states, in their effort to retain legitimacy, seek to sublimate social and political tensions and to keep the social order from fracturing. All around the world, a people's spring has taken off. From Chile to India, France to US, Haiti to Nigeria, South Africa to Colombia, Jordan to Sri Lanka, waves of strikes and mass protests have proliferated and in some instances appear to be acquiring an anti-capitalist character. Wars and external enemies allow the ruling groups to deflect attention away from domestic melee in their effort to maintain a grip on power as the crisis deepens. In the U.S., this sublimation has involved efforts to channel social unrest towards scapegoated communities such as immigrants or other marginalized groups. This is one key function of racism and was a core component of the Trump administration's political strategy, or towards an external enemy, which had clearly become a cornerstone of the Biden government's strategy well before the crisis in Eastern Europe. U.S. presidents historically reach their highest approval ratings when they launch wars. George W. Bush reached an all-time high of 90% in 2001 as his administration geared up to invade Afghanistan, and his father, George H. W. Bush, achieved an 89% approval rating in 1991. Right as the U.S. declared the end of its first invasion of Iraq and the liberation of Kuwait. It is unlikely that an increasing militarization of the world economy can, in the long run, offset either the economic or the political dimensions of the crisis of global capitalism. Global capitalism is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic with more inequality, more authoritarianism, more militarization, and more civic and political strife. In the U.S., the class struggle is heating up with a wave of strikes and of unionization drives in Amazon, Starbucks, and elsewhere in the gig economy. The current inflationary spiral and the escalation of the class struggle in the United States and around the world point to the inability of the ruling groups to contain the expanding crisis. The drive by the capitalist state to externalize the political fallout of the crisis increases the danger that international tensions and localized conflicts will snowball into broader international conflagrations of unforeseen consequences.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the present and future of Albania in a conversation with Albanian historian and author Olsi Yazici. But first, this brief analysis.
Albania is a small country we rarely hear about in the news. One of the reasons for this is that the US decided to turn this southern Balkan state on the Adriatic coast into a base of operations against Russia and Muslim countries such as Iran and Turkey in the early 2000s. Beyond its geographic location, it is the fact that Albania is the only Muslim-majority nation in Europe, with approximately 70% of the population adhering to Islam, that made it a target for US domination. Following the collapse of communism in the 1990s, the US aggressively expanded its strategic presence into Eastern Europe and the Balkans, including into Albania. Albania had been ruled by the communist dictator Enver Hoxha for decades, who proclaimed Albania to be the first officially atheist state in the world and who actively persecuted all religious activity. Despite this severe repression, Hoxha was not successful in extinguishing the religious beliefs of the Albanians, particularly the Muslim population. After the collapse of communist rule, Albanians revived religious life and re-established connections with their fellow Muslim brethren in the Muslim Ummah, particularly with Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. This caused an alarm in the United States and Europe, who feared the emergence of a majority Muslim country on the European continent with close strategic relations with the mentioned Muslim nations. A strategic campaign was initiated by the United States and its vassals to first strategically deny Albania to the Muslim world and to once again de-Islamize Albania, this time by using the excuse of fighting terrorism to ban all contacts between official Albanian Muslim organizations with any Muslim organizations from Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries. after the failure of the US-backed and Emirati-financed coup d'etat in Turkey against President Erdogan, the religious affairs of the Sunni Muslims in Albania was handed over to the pro-US and pro-Zionist Gulenist cult headquartered in the US state of Pennsylvania, a cult which played a key role in the attempted coup d'etat in Turkey. All Albanian Muslim clerics who opposed the imposition of the Gulenist cult on their country were persecuted, imprisoned, or exiled. The US also forced the Albanian government to accept the permanent encampment of the remnants of the Rajavi terrorist cult on its soil, a cult responsible for the murder of over 17,000 people in Iran since the 1970s, a terrorist cult that the Iraqi government expelled after the end of Saddam's rule because of its crimes against the Iraqi people during that era. Albania was forced to accept them after literally no other country in the world would accept them on their soil. The US strategic campaign for Albania also weaponized the legitimate feelings of Albanians and the Albanian majority population in neighboring Kosovo to turn that region into a base against Serbia and Russia. In pursuit of these strategies, the United States, through its embassy and through organizations such as the Soros Foundation, has captured and bought the Albanian political leadership, similar to the fashion it bought and captured elites in countries such as Ukraine. This puppet elite is committing the same crimes and abuses that other US-backed elites in other Muslim nations are committing, with the same result of turning the people against anyone and anything related to America. It appears the Albanian people are beginning to resist this US diktat and will eventually replace the current leadership controlled by the US with leaders who will re-establish relations with important Muslim nations in accordance with Albania's real national interests and the deep-held religious beliefs of its people.
Dr. Yazizis, thank you so much for joining us. There's not many programs done on Albania. It's a relatively small country. It's one that maybe the big news organizations might not want to spend a lot of time on. It is also one of those countries which is very interestingly completely dominated by the West. A lot of stories going on there that if it was in any other country, it would be headline news. And yet we see that absolutely nothing is talked about it. Please explain to us, because we have an actual terrorist cult organization now that is in Albania. Again, for us in Iran, very important because they killed 17,000 people in Iran, which is the Rajavi cult that used to be in Iraq. And when the Saddam regime was overthrown by the US, they end up in Albania. How did that happen? If you could give us a little background on them coming to Albania. And by the way, sorry, doctor, we have to also mention a lot of these people are brainwashed, because what ended up happening is a lot of them, when they got off the plane or when they were when they arrived in Albania, they actually defected. They ran away because it was the first time that they were allowed to leave that encampment that they had lived in for decades in Iraq. They weren't even allowed to leave that encampment in Iraq during the decades that they lived there. So the minute they got off the plane or the minute they entered Albania, approximately half of them, this is what the media was reporting, approximately half of them actually fled from that cult and sought asylum in different parts of Europe.
Yeah, you are correct. Rajavi cult was brought in Albania. They started to come since 2013. At first, the Americans brought them to Albania under the excuse that they had to bring only some of their leaders, but then the bulk of this cult was brought under the Obama administration, and it was the Secretary of State John Kerry who came to Albania and brought 3,000 of them. The Americans had big problem with Iraq, because Iraqis knew very well who the Rajavi cult were, and they have committed many crimes against the people of Iraq.
That's
and
right.
They were looking for a safe haven for these terrorists. They tried to send these terrorists in many countries. They approached Macedonia, Romania, probably even Ukraine. But many countries of Eastern Europe simply refused to host these terrorists. So they brought them to Albania. Now, the question that many international scholars ask is why Albania? The reason is simple. The Albanian government is a mafia government. For people who know local Albanian politics, most of our politicians, we have even government ministers, are drug dealers and who involve themselves in drug trafficking. So
you're saying that the organized crime is interwoven with the government there. There's not a line between organized crime and the government. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, in this moment that we are speaking together, we have two ministers of our Prime Minister Edi Rama, the Interior Minister Saimir Tahiri, who even welcomed the Mujahideens, and the ex-minister of economy, Lefter Koka, who are in jail. One of them is for stealing state funds, and the other is for being part of Ndrangheta. So,
I'm sorry, doctor, we have to explain. Ndrangheta is one of the Italian organized crime organizations of southern Italy.
Yeah, so Ndrangheta is one of the most dangerous branches of Italian mafia.
Yes.
So as you can imagine, people from our Prime Minister Edi Rama to even the President as well, they are people who have huge files by the Americans and the American drug agency DEA. So what Americans do with our politicians, they use blackmail in order to force them to do anything that the Americans want. So in the case of Albania, they are using our country as the trash bin of Europe. Mm-hmm. And in particular, they have turned Albania into the most staunch ally of Israel in the Muslim world and one of the greatest enemies of Turkey and Iran. So the bulk of the Mujahideens came to Albania in 2016. And as you rightly mentioned, after coming to Albania, there was mass defection from Rajavi cult because unlike the Gulenists, who many of them are educated people, but they are brainwashed and they believe that Fethullah Gulen is the Imam Mahdi and they have to obey to him even when he takes actions against Turkey and Islam, the Mujahideens in general, they are ignorant. They are people who for the past 30 years they have been abducted or cheated, taken from Iran, and they were kept in deserts in Iraq. Now, many of these people, because I have interviewed many of the defectors, they live in a utopian world. Mariam Rajavi, in their paramilitary camp that they had in Iraq and they have in Albania now, in the town of Manus, she does not allow her members to communicate with their families, to watch TV, to talk to foreigners via internet, and to possess even smartphones. These people, they are not allowed to marry and to have contact to the outside world.
Exactly.
So these people, the Rajavi cult is a very apocalyptic cult, is probably like Lord's Resistance Army. These people, they have very strange ideas about the world. But now, as you mentioned, is that after coming to Albania in 2016, many of the Rajavis, they came in contact with an open and generally free society, and there were mass defections. And now this was a nightmare for Mariam Rajavi, who rules this cult with threats and lies. She depicts herself to her followers like being a holy woman, and she depicts Masoud Rajavi, who is dead since long time, like being a messenger of God. And many of the members of the cult, they simply ran away. Now, nowadays, in this moment that we're speaking in Albania, there are many members within the Rajavi cult who would like to flee